Greetings, dear friends. Today we'll be exploring the teaching of Jesus given in Matthew 16, verse 25, where he said, "Whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." Now, typically we tend to read this as a heavy kind of teaching, that losing our life for Jesus will be burdensome or demanding, or that this demands that we give up things that bring us delight, constricting us to some kind of boring grey conformity that is scratchy and heavy. But I've come to realize that it is quite the opposite. It is the key to actually becoming truly unburdened and free. This is a radical invitation to exhilarating freedom, if we really hear what Jesus is saying. So let's look at this life that we try to save and that we are being invited to lose. I had a dream recently where I knew that I was about to die and was quite scared of the unknown of it, but also had a sense that it would somehow be okay. And in this dream, as I surrendered to the dying process, I felt myself slipping backward, withdrawing from and through the cells of my body, leaving them behind and kind of dissolving into a vast, quiet darkness. This dissolution process did not feel scary at all, but felt like a gentle homecoming into freedom and belonging. And surrendering to the process felt like the most natural release. The next day, I carried this sense of release and freedom with me through the day, as one does with sometimes the sense of what a dream leaves behind in you. But I realized that this was a very significant dream, and I've been reflecting on it since. I found it a very reassuring image of the dying process itself, where according to many people who've experienced near-death experiences or those who've accompanied people in the process of dying, especially terminally ill people, people have reported that death is a safe and natural transition. Kathleen Dowling Singh, who has accompanied many terminally ill people through the dying process, wrote, "Death, as no other moment we encounter in life, announces itself in resplendent silence. The time of dying effects a transformation from perceived tragedy to experienced grace. Dying offers the possibility of entering the radiance, the vastness of our essential nature." One of the people she journeyed with through their terminal illness said to her, "I realized about halfway through this terminal illness that I'm not in control, and my body sure isn't. It's in the hands of something far greater than me, and that's what I'm staying connected with." I know that some people listening to these talks are facing the question of death. And I highly recommend Kathleen Dowling Singh's book, The Grace in Dying, if you haven't read it yet. And her unequivocal reassurance is, dying is safe. You are safe. Your loved one is safe. As he was nearing his own death, Father Thomas Keating wrote a number of poems which are real treasures of insight and depth and invitation. And in one of these, he wrote, "In the transition from death to eternal life, the silence of pre-existence bursts into boundless joy." I'll read that again. "In the transition from death to eternal life, the silence of pre-existence bursts into boundless joy." This is a beautiful illustration of the transition that takes place during the nearing death process. But this dream about dying has struck me as not just an image of death at the end of our physical lives. It holds an invitation similar to the one Jesus gave when he said, "Whoever loses their life for me will find it." And where he talked about a grain of wheat needing to fall to the ground and die in order to realize the abundant life potential that is hidden within it. Many of us have read this with a sense of heaviness and trepidation as a command to give up the things you enjoy and live a burdensome, boring life with a kind of oppressive threat of grinding humiliation and subservience. But in working with this over the past few years, I have realized that it is ultimately an invitation to freedom. Freedom from the prison of the selves we get so caught up in. This is one of our human traits that is a consequence of our wonderful gift of being able to imagine. We use this imagination to weave stories about ourselves and the world and God and everybody else. And this imagination and weaving stories is not a problem in itself. The problem comes in when we find ourselves believing the story of me that our minds have woven out of the stimuli and experiences of our lives. That self that we weave then becomes the lens through which I look at the world, and it's always a distortion of reality because it has a curvature that bends around me. Events and people are interpreted through this lens of my perspective and my interests. What will hurt me or benefit me? Who is threatening me? Who can save me? And without knowing it, we become locked in the prison cell of our own mind's what I call selfing project. That becomes a prison. And because this self that we have created feels fragile and threatened, we get caught in reactive patterns and try to protect and defend it. And throughout our lifetime, our reactions from the standpoint of the small self have formed a kind of layering of conditioned responses until eventually we have no idea what is a true response and what is conditioned. Some years ago, I had a dream about untying the inner knots. And at the same time, this image of untying knots came up from a number of different sources. And I usually take that as a nudge to take something seriously. And I've realized that this untying of inner knots is the inner work that is so important if we are ever going to recognize the prison of self that we're caught in. Becoming aware of what we are doing and why we are doing it starts to pull at the threads that can unravel the whole knotty jumble that we thought was reality. As this process has unfolded for me, I've realized how much of my inner anguish, insecurity, and hurtful behavior towards myself and others was driven by this knotty jumble that I thought was myself. I've come to recognize that whenever there's a knot in my stomach, it is sure to be associated with some knot of self that my mind has constructed. And the untangling process has started to release me from a lot of the anguish and suffering that I've been trapped in my whole life that I thought was kind of just, you know, normal life. But it started to bring a profound sense of freedom and inner spaciousness and contentment, which I never really thought possible. And I've found that a regular contemplative practice, such as centering prayer or meditation, is crucial in this process, because we have no way to unravel the knots of self that are created by the mind using the mind. That's just going to create another whole knot. We're also so infatuated with our thinking that we can't imagine a way of knowing or being that is outside of thought. And this thought just keeps bending and looping around ourselves. But in a regular contemplative practice, what we're doing is we simply recognize when we are caught in thought and gently let go, returning to the present moment through some anchor, such as our breath or a sacred word. That's really what it boils down to over and over again. And the key is in the letting go, because every letting go is a small dying to self, a willingness to lose ourself so that we can find our true selves, who we are in God, who we have in fact been all along in God, just blinded by our selfing project. And so this is the practice, not only in our regular contemplative sitting times, but also as an attitude to carry with us into our daily lives. Recognize when we're caught up in thought, which invariably gets tangled in the thicket of selfing. Gently let go and return to presence, to the breath, to the word. Martin Laird, in his book Into the Silent Land, he writes brilliantly on this whole process of being freed from the self. And he wrote, "We progress in overcoming the illusion of separation from God when we learn how to deal with the barrage of thoughts that pummels us into misery." The barrage of thoughts that pummels us into misery. That's a good description. Because we've lived our lives in the world that is shaped by the selfing project, we can't easily recognize what is real and what isn't, what is threat and what isn't. So we live with a lot of illusion that we are surrounded by problems that we have to solve. This is one of the big issues of the small self. It tries to take control of life to ensure its happiness, safety, success, and survival. And this leads to an enormous amount of fear and anguish, because life is seldom in our control. But this need for us to take charge and solve the problems of our lives is very strong. Even this invitation from Jesus, "Whoever loses their life for me will find it," becomes a problem that we think that we should solve. And so we tie ourselves into yet another knot. The beautiful thing is that this is all held in and unfolding in the grace of God. Our lives are already held in God. Our true selves are already one with God, at home in the infinite, swimming in the ocean of God's mercy. And in fact, God is the initiator and perfecter of this awakening process from our small selves. You know, in our dualistic imaginations, we imagine that we are somehow embarking on a pilgrimage of awakening or a salvation project or whatever we want to call it, moving from here to there, when all along we're held in what initiates this and fulfills it. Were it not for grace, we would never even have an inkling that much of the anguish we experience is not real or necessary, that freedom from captivity is possible, as Jesus declared in Luke 4, verse 18. So we're not even in control of this losing our lives to find our life process. This is the beauty of the way that Father Thomas Keating describes the centering prayer practice, because it simply involves a recognition and ever so gently letting go on our part and bringing our consent to God's presence and action within us, the divine therapist. Only in this radical surrender from seeing myself as the agent of my own and other people's salvation and falling into grace am I open enough to allow the transformation process to unfold within me, initiated and fulfilled by God. Sometimes this process of being broken out of our prison of self involves searing grace, where we might experience loss and painful unraveling of the self. This too is an invitation to recognize where we have over-identified with some aspect of the self, and then to surrender, even though this may be one of the hardest things we have to face. Meister Eckhart wrote, "If you want the kernel, you must break the shell." And that breaking can be painful. But each moment of surrender, each letting go, is a recognition and a breaking of the shell, allowing the life of the kernel to unfold from within. Rumi wrote similarly, this that is tormented and very tired, tortured with restraints like a madman, this heart, still you keep breaking the shell to get the taste of its kernel. Still you keep breaking the shell to get a taste of its kernel. He also wrote, "Here's the new rule, break the wine glass and fall toward the glass blower's breath." That's beautiful, fall toward the glass blower's breath. It's all an invitation to recognize and let go of the selfing project that causes us so much anguish and despair, and at the same time an invitation to the most profound intimacy, to experiencing the breath of eternity in our breath, to swim freely in the ocean of the Beloved, in whom we live and move and have our being already, the safest place to be. God is more intimate than any knowledge we have about God, more immediate than any program we have for reaching God, as encompassing and nurturing as the womb that holds an unborn child. Any imaginings we have that we have to be something, achieve something, or please God in some way, any of those are what keep us from knowing this immediacy. This is sometimes called contemplative knowing, to distinguish it from our ordinary conceptual knowledge. Contemplative knowing is more like the quiet unknowing that we come to in silence and surrender, opening us to a deeper awareness. As we unhook our attention from the conditioning of thought and what it tells us about ourselves and God, we get glimpses of this resting self that is already resting in God, enwombed by God, one with God. As Richard Rohr recently wrote after an 8-day retreat, "I believe only the contemplative mind can allow transformation at the deepest levels and help us rest in the awareness of God's loving presence." So it will be helpful here to give an example from one of my own selfing projects. And I've noticed that there's not just one self-image. There are a number of selves that I find my identity located in at different times, in different contexts. And one of these is the achieving Sharon. I've recently taken on some editing contract work, and one of the aspects of this work is that you are rated for the quality of your work, so that they can ensure a standard of quality for their clients. And it's been really interesting and at times painful, even excruciating to experience this, because sometimes the reasons for a poor rating are unjustified. And it's felt like being back at school. It's hooked into some of those same issues that I experienced as a scholar. I felt elated at the good scores, feeling myself feasting on the praise and the sense of value it brings, but then crushed by the low scores. It's sometimes felt quite childish, but anyway, that's what it's been. And what I would like to do is to enjoy the elation of the good scores, but let go and be all zen about the low scores. But it doesn't work that way, and just because this is happening right now, I can't not use the example of Donald Trump, who's trying to do precisely this by insisting on counting the red votes in the US election results, but not the blue ones, because those count against him. This is not how democracy works, and it doesn't work with us either. Because I've realized that by feasting on the self-aggrandizement of good scores, I'm building the very construct of the self that then feels crushed by the low scores. This does not mean not allowing myself to receive and enjoy positive feedback, but when I allow my sense of identity to be defined by it, when I grasp onto that self and feed myself stories about how lucky they are to have me working for them or whatever, then I'm giving that system the power to cause me anguish. As Eckhart Tolle says, deriving our sense of identity from our successes and popularity is a cheap substitute for who we really are, and I would add a dangerous and destructive substitute. At the moment, we're witnessing a terrifying example in Donald Trump of just how dangerous the selfing project can be. The radius of curvature of his ego self has become so tightly bound up around himself that he's somehow managed to suck a whole lot of people into his orbit and is wreaking havoc with his blindness to the prison of illusion, divisiveness, prejudice, and eco-dominance that he's woven around himself and others. Having said that, I believe that grace can even permeate this scenario. As a giant mirror is being held up to all of us who claim to follow Christ, showing us just how dangerous the ego can be in its delusions about God, self, and other. And again, to quote something that Richard Rohr wrote recently, he wrote, "I'm convinced that the root of our divisions can only be overcome by a unitive consciousness at every level, personal, relational, social, political, cultural, and spiritual." So returning to our own knotty selfing project, the anguish caused when things don't go our way or when we feel out of control or under attack, this can actually present us with an opportunity for practice. Whenever I feel that familiar pinch of humiliation, failure, or despair, when my self feels crushed in some way, this is giving me a clue about the selfing project and giving me a reminder that this is an area where I can let go. For me, this has meant taking both the positive and negative feedback a lot more lightly, and at times visualizing myself withdrawing from that whole achieving Sharon self into the quiet free place of resting in God in the silence and emptiness of no self. The image from that dream that I described in the beginning can be a helpful way to visualize this, a gentle withdrawal from all the cells or selves that we've allowed ourselves to be defined and confined by, and resting in the vast eternal embrace of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. This is what it means to be a living sacrifice, continually choosing over and over to give up our grasping onto the imagined self, letting go of the concepts we construct around who we are, and falling into the silent vastness of the unknowing immediacy of being who we are in God. To quote again from one of Thomas Keating's final poems, "Our true nature is stillness, the source from which we come. The deep listening of pure contemplation is the path to stillness. All words disappear into it, and all creation awakens to the delight of just being. All words disappear into it, and all creation awakens to the delight of just being." The Quaker Thomas Kelly wrote, "Deep within us all, there is an amazing inner sanctuary of the soul, a holy place, a divine center, a speaking voice to which we may continually return. Eternity is at our hearts, pressing upon our time-torn lives. warming us with intimations of an astounding destiny, calling us home to itself. Yielding to these persuasions, gladly committing ourselves in body and soul, utterly and completely to the light within, is the beginning of true life. And then to quote Eckhart Tolle, who uses non-religious language to express this so clearly, he wrote, "Some people get angry when they hear me say that problems are illusions. The collective disease of humanity is that people are so engrossed in what happens, so hypnotized by the world of fluctuating forms, so absorbed in the content of their lives, they have forgotten the essence, that which is beyond content, beyond form, beyond thought. They are so consumed by time that they have forgotten eternity, which is their origin, their home, their destiny. Eternity is the living reality of who you are." So I want to end this reflection with sharing a delightful discovery I recently made, which is an alternative translation to the line from the Lord's Prayer that has been translated as "deliver us from evil" or "rescue us from the evil one" in Matthew 6 verse 13. The ancient Greek word that has been translated as evil is poneros. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it derives from the word ponos, meaning toil, pain, anguish, distress, and suffering. So another way of translating this verse 13 is deliver us from what causes us toil, pain, anguish, distress, and suffering. The usual reading, deliver us from evil, creates a tendency in us to externalize the cause of evil, often picturing either the devil, who's the usual scapegoat for all things evil, or some group that we differ with or feel threatened by, and that we have relegated to the domain of evil. So in praying, deliver us from evil, we could in fact be praying, deliver us from them. This could entrench some of the conditioned dualistic divides that keep us hardened against the other, whoever we imagine that to be. And we could be, in effect, asking God to take our side against the perceived evil other, and unconsciously reinforcing our sense of a God of vengeance and judgment, a God who takes my side. And that is pure illusion. By contrast, to pray, deliver us from what causes us toil, pain, anguish, distress, and suffering, appeals more to God's heart of compassion and opens us to receive healing and tenderness. But deeper than that, it is to place our small selves in the grace of God, the grace of the God of freedom and life, to deliver us from the prison of self that is the root cause of that which causes us and one another toil, pain, anguish, distress, and suffering. In my school days under Christian National Education, we used to pray the Lord's Prayer every day with this line, deliver us from evil. And many of us pray this regularly as part of the liturgy. But imagine if instead we regularly prayed, deliver us from ourselves, or deliver us from selfing. Offering to let go of our small selves as a living sacrifice in that moment, opening to the expansive, immediate, and inclusive unity of the heart of God. What a different inner and outer world we could live in. So on this webpage underneath this video, you will find a link to a guided prayer time of practicing this letting go of